This is Alex Dreyer speaking from the NBC box in the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco, where the Treaty of Peace with Japan has just been concluded. The concluding remarks given by Secretary of State Dean Acheson, the presiding officer at this conference. In a few moments, we will give you a direct transcription of those concluding remarks by Secretary of State Dean Acheson. 48 nations signed the Treaty of Peace with Japan today in a very impressive ceremony here at the War Memorial Opera House. Immediately following the conclusion of the treaty signing and the remarks made by Secretary of State Dean Acheson, the reporters wanted and did get pictures of the presiding officer Acheson and the premier of Japan, Yoshida, shaking hands down in the rostrum. In their background, the treaty books signed by all 48 nations which participated here today. As you know, Russia, Poland, and Czechoslovakia did not sign. And now we switch you to Secretary of State Dean Acheson.
Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the closing moments of our conference. And it falls to the President to say the last words of farewell. May I begin with some words which are very close to my heart, in expressing the deepest appreciation of which I am capable to this conference, for the trust which it reposed in me in selecting me to serve as your presiding officer. I have endeavored to retain your trust. May I also say to this gracious city of San Francisco and to the great state of California, and to those thousands of volunteer workers who worked so steadily and so happily to make our meetings a success, to make our stay in San Francisco so pleasant, and to contribute so greatly to the happiness and enjoyment of the members of our family. How deeply grateful all of us are to this city, to this state, and to the thousands of men and women of San Francisco and California who have worked to make our conference a success. I know that as you sat here this morning and watched this very moving ceremony, a great crowd of memories came into your minds, not only into the minds of the delegates in this hall and the audience in this hall, but in the vast audience which was looking on at this ceremony throughout the length and breadth of the United States. A great flood of memories of past days, days which were anxious, days which were full of sorrow, days which were full of grim determination. And I know that many families today were conscious of absences. And many were conscious that those who were absent had given their lives to bring about this day. And it was fitting, it is very fitting, that all of those memories of all of these people here, throughout this country, throughout the world, should culminate today in this act of reconciliation. Because what you have seen this morning is something unique in history. You have seen an act of greatness of spirit. An act, a true act of reconciliation. And because it was that, it was an act which, as Mr. J. Wadeen pointed out, as Sir Zafrullah Khan pointed out, as Mr. Dulles pointed out, is in accordance with the fundamental moral principles of the great spiritual teachers and leaders of all nations and of all religions. And it was for this reason, I think, again, as Mr. Dulles suggested to us last night, that we were able to accomplish here what we have accomplished. Because all of us, in the words of Benjamin Franklin, all of us doubted something of our infallibility. And all of us worked together, giving up much that was close to our hearts, much that was close to our economic interests, for the purpose of bringing about this peace of reconciliation. And we were able to do that because we were doing something which lifted our spirits, something of which we were proud. There was nothing mean, there was nothing sordid which lurked in any corner of this treaty. There was nothing hidden, nothing that could not bear the broad, great light of day. And we were able to join in that sort of an effort, and we were able to sink our differences because we were going forward in a great effort, making a great new step in history, and hoping from this day forward a new chapter is opening in the history of the world. And as Mr. Morrison said to us this morning, this is not an ending, this is a beginning. We signed this great treaty this morning, but we must live this treaty from this day onward. And it depends upon each nation represented here, each individual represented here, each individual of each nation, to make this treaty be what it is in words. And by no means least of all, it rests with our Japanese friends to see that this treaty reaps its true fruit. And I say to them that a great broad highway to a position of equality, of honor, of friendship in the world lies open to you. All the obstacles on that highway have been cleared away so far as governments can clear them away. The obstacles that remain, only you can remove. And you can remove those if you act with other peoples, with understanding, and with generosity, and with kindness. And all those qualities are inherent in the nature of your people. And what we urge you to do is to make those qualities which are so inherent in the Japanese people the policy of the Japanese government. We regret that there are some who were unable or unwilling to join our meeting, and others, we regret, who came here but were unable or unwilling to join in this great constructive effort. But what we have done here, we have done both for ourselves and for those who did not come here. Because we have laid a great peace for all people, not merely those here, but for all peoples throughout the world. And those who were unwilling to work with us, those who criticized our efforts, for those people we feel no bitterness, but we urge them now to join in the great effort which lies before all of us. And may I close this conference with words which, in many languages, in many forms, in many religions, have brought comfort and strength. May the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, be amongst us and remain with us always.
You have been listening to Secretary of State Dean Acheson making his concluding remarks to the Japanese Peace Treaty Conference here in the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. Dean Acheson was indeed happy, he evidenced throughout the signing as the 48 nations came up to the rostrum and affixed their signatures to this treaty of peace with Japan. We can underscore one comment made by Herbert Morrison, the British foreign minister, when he said, "We readily acknowledge its imperfections, more heavily on some than on others, but our aim is peace. That takes effort, and effort requires sacrifice." Now gathered with me here in the NBC box in the War Memorial Opera House are newsmen Merrill Muller, Elmer Peterson, Ray Henley, and H.V. Kaldenborn. My name is Alex Dreyer. We'll start it off with H.V. Kaldenborn. He has a few comments to make on the earlier address given by Herbert Morrison.
Mr. Morrison began his talk by saying it is those who want peace who should make the peace, and he looked at the empty seats of the Soviet delegation as he spoke those words. He added that those who have suffered little, meaning the Soviet Union in its 6 days of war against Japan, have made no contribution, which is certainly true so far as the proceedings of this conference are concerned. He also voiced a word of warning to the people of Japan that the evolution of democracy will be difficult and long, and that they should not be discouraged. Also, like a good trade unionist, he urged them that they should not discourage their trade unions and that there should be no social reaction in Japan. Because, Mr. Morrison is quite right, if Japan needs any warning, it is not that about going to the left, but about going to the right. Does anyone else want to comment on the Morrison speech?
Yes, I think Mr. Morrison made one remark. He said this treaty was in the deliberate moral tradition. That showed how the United Kingdom shares the underlying theme which was expressed by Mr. Acheson today, namely the spiritual side of this treaty, the spiritual victory. In other words, we've gained a great moral achievement here, and that is shared entirely by the United Kingdom and by, of course, the delegates who signed for their nations this morning.
That was Elmer Peterson. This is Ray Henley. And I'd like to make this extemporaneous comment as to my reactions on this conference now that it's over. To me, this conference ends with three men standing out above all others. First of all, General Douglas MacArthur, whose occupation policies were led up to Japan getting ready for this conference. Without his guidance, without his genius, without his guiding the Japanese people to this point, I doubt very much that this conference could have been held this soon. Number two, Mr. John Foster Dulles. In my judgment, he is almost solely responsible for getting together all of the conflicting views of the many nations that have been here. And number three, the Secretary of State, Mr. Dean Acheson, whose magnificent conduct on the opening day of this conference was, in my judgment, responsible for the successful termination of this meeting. Here is Red Muller.
The thing I noticed, Ray, immediately, was in making the comparison between this ceremony here at the Opera House in San Francisco and the ceremonies aboard the Missouri, which I covered exactly 6 years and 6 days ago today, the surrender ceremonies in Tokyo Bay. Then it was General MacArthur who had the rostrum and step by step guided the surrender ceremonies through, just as we have watched this morning Dean Acheson do exactly the same thing here with the 48 powers that have now signed the treaty document. Also, I was particularly impressed this morning with Dean Acheson's ad-lib speech. It came straight from the heart. It seemed to have a great deal of feeling in it, and I liked the title he gave to the treaty. He called it a great act of spirit. He said it was a great act of spirit and reconciliation. And I think that's been the theme right straight through these ceremonies here in San Francisco. And I believe Alex Dreyer wants to add a word to that.
With reference to what Ray Henley said a moment ago in mentioning General Douglas MacArthur, I think it's fitting at this particular point that we release to you the contents of a telegram sent by John Foster Dulles, the architect of the Treaty of Peace with Japan, to General Douglas MacArthur, the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. Quote, "As we are about to sign the Japanese peace treaty, my thought, like the thoughts of other delegates, will turn to you. You will be present in spirit, for the signing delegations and the witnessing multitudes all know that without your great leadership in war and peace, the results achieved here would not have been attainable. With deep personal regards and profound appreciation of the unwavering support which you have given me, I am faithfully yours, John Foster Dulles." I think we can say, too, that it was quite surprising that someone did not offer a resolution here at this conference in San Francisco, inviting officially General Douglas MacArthur to be present at the signing. Would you agree with that, H.V.?
Yes, I think that the telegram sent by John Foster Dulles answers the purpose, because if General MacArthur had come, it would have created quite a stir. He would have been called on for a speech, and he might have said something that would have sounded a note of bitterness. I might hope that he would not, but after all, his speech in Cleveland did contain certain political overtones that should be entirely absent from an occasion such as this. Well, now I suggest we go to a less pleasant topic, to the one-hour press conference that Mr. Gromyko gave this morning. I hate to call it a press conference. It was in reality a propaganda conference. At least that was my impression of it. He merely repeated all the things that he has said from the floor, repeated them without practically a change of phraseology, and gave out a long statement reiterating all the charges that the Soviet Union has made. And I venture to predict that that statement will not get very much space either on the radio or in the American press, because it was so patently a statement of propaganda. There were some interesting questions and answers. I have a few, and I've no doubt that some of my fellow commentators have also noted down some. For example, I asked Mr. Gromyko whether, if Russia and Red China would disarm if Japan remains disarmed. Well, that would have given him a chance to say, why, yes, if we can work out an agreement under which Japan will remain disarmed as we have asked, certainly we'll agree to go along. Instead of that, his reply was, that's a separate question. That's the sort of answers he gave right along. We asked him about a non-aggression pact with Japan, and he says, I have nothing to say. In other words, when it came to anything in the way of a constructive contribution, he was completely vacant. Wasn't that your impression, Ray Henley?
Yes, and I think that the conference, it seems to me, revealed another point, namely the paucity, the lack of any effective tactics on the part of the Russians. They're fine. When it comes to bulldozing, grand. They get everywhere. And when they have the power to back up their bulldozing, they can go to town. But when it comes to persuasion, appeal to reason and justice, when they have to move along that line in order to get to a certain point, then they fail utterly. And I think, Elmer, wasn't it you who said yesterday that they seem to lack in certain spiritual qualities which stands them in bad stead?
Yes, I felt that the outstanding question at this press conference this morning was the question, of course, what is Russia going to do now? She has lost in prestige. She has been outmaneuvered. She has tried a propaganda program. As Mr. Kaltenborn said, it was a feeble thing in its way. She tried to use the press as a forum. But we still have the question, what does she intend to do now to try as a counter move, to try to regain prestige? And when the reporters today tried to pin Mr. Gromyko down, as Mr. Kaltenborn has pointed out, Mr. Gromyko was evasive all the time. They tried to pin him down on specific points to see what he had in mind. But it's clear that he was out to propagandize Red China as far as possible. He used the threat of war, but in general terms. He said this treaty represented preparation for war. But when he was asked specifically at one time whether he envisaged the possibility of war with this country in Asia, he was evasive. In other words, he hopes to achieve something with that threat of war. He hopes to achieve some propaganda effect in Red China. But I agree with Ray Henley that, to a certain extent, the Russians have shown at this conference that they are more or less playing by ear. They seem to be floundering, in a sense. They are going back to pat arguments, old arguments, and, in effect, I say the big question now is, what are they going to do? Because certainly their simulated walkout in effect this morning did not achieve any great effect. The remarkable thing here this morning was the release of tension and the friendliness and the spirit of unity that prevailed the moment those chairs in this auditorium became empty. Ray Muller?
Well, there's an interesting little sidelight going on down here in the, on the floor of the War Memorial Opera House, Pete. The general public has been allowed up to look at the treaties, at least the common copies of the treaties. The master copy has already been taken away by John W. Foley of the State Department's Protocol Division. But the public now, several hundred of them, have gathered in a line and are filing past the MP guards, getting a look at the signatures and the two common copies of the treaty. I wonder if we can project our thoughts, gentlemen, a little further ahead to answer the question, or try to answer the question, what happens next? Tomorrow, you know, we sign a military alliance with Japan, which gives us bases out there for our troops, planes, and ships. And I noticed this morning that Morrison got a word in edgewise about the future threat of Japanese industrial competition in world trade. Mr. Carltonborn, like myself, has just recently been in Japan. Perhaps I'll ask that question of him. What happens next?
Of course, Japan must export, must develop her industries, because with 84 million people confined to an area less large than California, with less arable land than the state of Kentucky, it's perfectly obvious that her only opportunity is to export people or goods. Now, she can't export people because the immigration laws prevent Japanese from going anywhere in large numbers. Yet they are increasing at the rate of 1 million a year. What's the answer? The answer is the development of Japanese industries to make it once again a great industrial state, devoted this time to the production of goods for peace rather than goods for war. Now, Asiatic countries are already apprehensive, as I found out in traveling through them a few weeks ago. They fear Japanese competition. They have no reason to fear it if Japan can produce goods at a lower cost than other countries. She is entitled to export and to sell those goods. And there must be a little less national selfishness on the part of the receivers of Japanese goods in order to make possible the recovery of Japan and meeting those obligations which these very Asiatic countries expect Japan to provide. I am very happy that we are going to sign this special treaty of alliance with Japan, because it will discourage the Soviet Union from making that attack which she proposes. She now has a mission in Japan. And we were asking Gromyko this morning, what about that mission? Are you going to withdraw it? And he merely replied, we have a mission in Japan under international agreement. Well, that international agreement has run out with the signing of that treaty. And that may be the first important issue that arises between Japan and the Soviet Union. What is to become of the Russians who are now in Japan as an occupied country and who ought to get out now that Russia is a free country? What about that?
Well, H.V., I think that only accents one point, your last remarks, that heretofore we've accused the Russians of having an inferiority complex. We now can accuse them, and I think rightly, of having an inferiority complex. And with reference to that Gromyko conference, we can say that perhaps there is a red square in Moscow, but there wasn't a square red today or any time here at the conference in San Francisco. Two remarks out of that conference. It is clear, he said, that without the USSR, a settlement in the Far East is impossible. I think that is something which Elmer Peterson had reference to a moment ago with the threat of an expansion of war in the Far East. Elmer?
Yes, of course, how far Russia carries this is another matter. Russia, of course, can threaten an extension of war, but whether she wants to extend that war is an entirely different matter. I agree that much depends on Japan. Secretary Acheson today, when he said that in the last analysis, the success of this treaty depends on the Japanese themselves, looked squarely at the Japanese delegation. As Mr. Carltonborn has said, that depends a great deal on how they conduct their trade. It also depends now on how they conduct their negotiations on reparations. It depends on how they can maintain a proper balance between their own ambitions and the obligation they now have to properly reward those nations which feel they are entitled to reparations, how they conduct themselves as a nation. In short, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch how the Japanese government reacts and how the Japanese people react to this conference. For certainly this time they have seen the outstrand, as Mr. Acheson said, a broad highway opened up. It's up to them to travel that highway, and the world will be watching.
Yes, Elmer, and here is a point that I think that we could well keep in mind, namely, that the treaty was signed today, but the treaty is not yet in force. And so far as we are concerned in our own United States government, it will take some time before this treaty is ratified by the United States Senate. Senator Sparkman told us last night that he thought that it would not be presented until next January. If that is true, we can see that we have a number of months in which to cogitate this treaty, to see how the Japanese react to it, to see what happens on the many various fronts of world affairs which we now have got to watch so closely. And I think that that point will also give the American people a wonderful opportunity to assess their responsibilities which are going to arise out of this treaty. H.V.?
Well, it must be almost closing off time. It seems to me that we all of us have done an enormous amount of talking in these last few days, and I hope that our audience will forgive us for some of the flubs and some of the mistakes which we have inevitably made when, under the pressure of events, we were suddenly called on to give wise comments on very difficult topics. However, a commentator is never at loss for a word, whether or not it always be the right word. So, Alec, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, as you told me a long time ago, H.V. Kaltenborn, the greatest asset that a broadcaster has is the shortness of the public's memory, for which we say amen once a week. Ray Muller?
I think, gentlemen, if we all need a symbol of what's happened here at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco the past few days, that symbol has just been given to us by a little incident on the stage. The Japanese flag this morning for the first time appeared among the flags of the other nations. And a few minutes ago, Japanese photographers were up there getting pictures of the Japanese flag, Japan, back among the community of nations. Here's Elmer Peterson.
I think at this time, many of us are reminded of the beginning words of the preamble to the Charter of UNESCO, the effect that war begins in the minds of men. Here we've had a conference dealing with the thinking of people, what they have in their minds. And from that viewpoint, I think it's been a great success. It's been a great success spiritually, too. But I think we have a sign here that we are getting somewhere in the struggle to eliminate from men's minds the thought of the necessity of war.
Yes, and I can say to you that as a reporter of 30 years standing, I don't know when I have ended up a story with a better inner feeling than I have about this meeting. I think we can all have a feeling of well-being, of confidence in our country, of pride in our country. This whole operation here has been operated from a nonpartisan basis and has been operated on a good basis, a healthy basis, and certainly some good should come from it.
I don't know how much time we have left, but I know there is time enough to comment on what is at this moment going on the stage. As Merrill Muller told you a few moments ago, a long line of people is filing past that treaty of peace, glancing at it with eager eyes, and sensing in their hearts that it symbolizes peace. Peace, which is the longing of every human heart. And I see now that people have even come in from off the streets, and this line seems to be extending much longer than it was originally. For all these people are anxious to get a glimpse of a document that means peace. Yes, that is the thing we must remember, that it's the people who count for peace.
And that completes NBC's coverage of the Japanese Peace Treaty Conference. Today, the fifth and final day of the conference, we heard addresses by British Foreign Secretary Herbert Morrison and Secretary of State Dean Acheson, and we witnessed the representatives of 49 nations sign the treaty. To conclude our coverage, you have just heard a discussion by NBC News commentators Elmer Peterson, Merrill Muller, Ray Henley, Alex Dreyer, and H.V. Kaltenborn. And that's all from the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.